the country ham industry is its own worst enemy many times, and understanding what it needs to do to make itself look on par with Italian cured hams.
Yeah, you tell my wife it's charcuterie, she's like, oh yeah. You say it's country ham, she's like, oh no, no, no way. It's like, it's the same thing.
Welcome to episode 251 of Bourbon Pursuit. And I hope you all are hanging in there with your quarantine hair, because I know right now mine's looking pretty shaggy. I'm due for a haircut. But before I get to the news, I want to tell you once again about Whiskey From Home. With the help of some of the best names in bourbon, we are doing a 5.5-hour live stream of whiskey-soaked entertainment on May 2nd, starting at 12 p.m. Eastern. So right now, go to whiskeyfromhome.com and get your free ticket. There's sessions on bourbon history, the best bourbons on the shelf right now, blind flights, how to hunt for great bourbon, a virtual food pairing with Peggy No Stevens, and a virtual bourbon tasting with our good friend, Fred Minnick. The shopping list for everything that you need to follow along is at whiskeyfromhome.com, so go there, check it out. It's a free event, so come and spend your Saturday afternoon with us. Now, bourbon in a decanter, does it go bad? This is a question that was asked and answered with extensive research from advancedmixology.com. After you buy a bottle of bourbon, how should it be stored? Does it stay preserved for years or even decades if left unopened? What about decanting a bourbon? Can it go bad then? Well, it all comes down to aeration, and without giving too much of it away, you can read all the answers to these questions to the link from advancedmixology.com in our show notes. For today's podcast, we talk about bourbon and ham. Is that a pairing that you would expect? Well, to be honest, neither did I. I'm a sucker for killing a whole plate of prosciutto at a dinner party, but thanks to our guest Steve Coombs, I found a new love for country ham. When done right, the saltiness of the ham, it just hits all the right spots. And we sit down with Steve as he talks about his past life as a pizza judge. Yeah, you heard that right, a pizza judge. I mean, talk about a dream job. But then we get into hams, the diet of the pigs, curing processes, and even his professional opinion of those ham legs that you see hanging inside of rickhouses. I think that's going to surprise you. Of course, it wouldn't be complete if we didn't do a bourbon and ham pairing, so try not to salivate too much. All right, now don't forget it, whiskeyfromhome.com, go register and get your free ticket. And if you haven't had a chance yet, go to barrelbourbon.com and you can get cask strength bourbon, whiskey, rye, and rum all delivered direct to your door. Just look for the Buy Now button at the top of the page. All right, now here we go with the show. Here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. I'm a little sad right now. I'm actually really, really sad. We've had to cancel Bourbon and Beyond. I think many of you all know that, but that's the festival that I co-created with Danny Wimmer Presents, and COVID is forcing a lot of cancellations, especially in the music world. What's going to happen to the Kentucky Derby? No one really knows. But this Saturday would have been my 13th Kentucky Derby in a row to attend. And I'm just sad because that piece of that moment is gone. It's gone, that piece of culture, that piece of celebration. And it's not necessarily about the horses. It's about the gathering of the people, the smoking of cigars, the sipping of bourbon, seeing my wife go through, 15,000 different hats before she chooses one. So many great moments I've had over the years. I want to share one with you. Now, if you followed me, you know that I was a guest of the governor last year, and I've been in Millionaire's Row, and I've been around the celebrities and all that. And a lot of people will be like, That would be the one. That would be like the one memory that you would want to take away when you think about your experiences as from the Derby. I've also been a photographer on the Derby. I was on the finishing line in 2008 and got some really beautiful photos of Abe Bells before she passed away. And yet, that's not it either. No, my favorite Derby of all time was when I was in Peggy No Stevens' box with my wife. We were just pregnant. We were just getting out of that first trimester where we could start telling people. You know how it is if you've been pregnant. Well, I've never been pregnant. My wife's been pregnant, but I say we as in like, you know, family. And you get out of that first trimester and you're so excited to tell people. And we're Catholic, so that first step is always like, all right, who are going to be the godparents? So it was on Derby Day, like 2-3 years ago, that we were in Peggy's box and we asked Peggy if she would be the godmother to our son, Julian. And she cried, said yes, of course. And it was just a magical moment. It was a wonderful celebration. And then I think I lost a couple $100 on the race. But there's no replacing the Derby. We can't replace that. That's just a magical, magical moment. If you've ever been, you know what I'm talking about. But we're doing something that is as good as we possibly can present right now. And that's Whiskey from Home. It is an amazing lineup of bourbon personalities. And I hope you will join us all day Saturday as we drink bourbon, as we talk bourbon. We're going to be streaming across the interwebs, unlike any time before. This is the first. This is the first, to my knowledge, that we've ever seen something like this, a virtual conference in the bourbon world. And my hat's off to Kenny Coleman. He's just done such a good job, you know, stepping up and getting this thing going. On the back end, I'm trying to get all the streaming stuff set up. And Ryan's going to be making cocktails. And you know what? I'm going to try and make them alongside him. So I cannot wait to see how this goes for everybody. And I hope you will join us. It's this Saturday. I'm sure Kenny's already talked about it. And you're going to hear more about it later on. But it's going to be a great time. Is it going to replace the Derby? Nothing can replace that in our hearts. But what it can do is it can help us get us through the fact that we are missing the greatest 2 minutes in sports. So that's this week's Above the Char. This one came from the heart. If you have a heartfelt story about the Kentucky Derby, hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or go to my website, fredminnick.com, and send me an email. I like reading those kinds of stories. Until next week, cheers.
Welcome back to another episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. The whole team here today, we've got bourbon and we've got ham. We're going to be talking pigs and bourbon today. So this is something that I know Ryan and myself, we're big barbecue guys. We've got our green eggs. You've got your drum. You've got all kinds of things.
It's a barrel. But yes,
it's a barrel.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, I love charcuterie boards when I go out to restaurants too. Can't get enough of ham. And I mean, I remember we were talking about going to North Carolina. You're talking about the jamon ham. Is that what it is?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. The Serrano hams. The jamon.
See, jamon. Yeah. Jam.
Michael Jackson working there.
Yeah. It's the jamon. Yeah. The jam and ham.
Cured meats are like, you're talking my love language. You know.
And I used to raise pigs. So like this is like ham to me is like it's what I grew up with. We used to raise Duroc's and Berkshires and everything.
So no kidding.
Nice. Yeah, I had my
good
own
hogs. I knew you were in the hog business.
Did you ever bathe the pig in the mud?
Did I ever what?
You know, bathe the pig, you know, in the mud.
Yeah, we bathed them. Yeah, I'd had to clean them all the time because it'd get really bad. And we had some. We did have some Hampshires as well. I had like. And like one of these really nice prized Hampshires, and the damn thing died when it touched concrete. Like it was a carrier of what they called a stress gene. And one of my big contributions to the hog community is that I donated him to science instead of eating him after he died.
Do you get a tax write-off for that or something?
I think we did, but they've bred most of that out there.
Yeah, you can't eat them unless you cause its death, right? If it does that on its own, you gotta send
I don't
it off,
think
right?
There's any rules on that, whether you eat a hog.
They have to show up live to the butcher.
Whatever, it sounds delicious. So
if it's hit by a car, I think that's the only rule.
Well, we don't want to know how the sausage made, you know, no pun intended. But.
Who knows, we might get back into that action today and kind of talking about cured meats as well as we go through here. But you've already heard our guest today. So today as our guest, we've got Steve Coombs. Steve is all over the place. He knows about pigs. He knows about bourbon. He's been a writer for Bourbon Plus. He's also an author. He's been a contributing writer for Bourbon and Banter. So Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So, I mean, I kind of talked to you up a little bit there, but let's kind of talk about some of your bourbon cred. You know, how did you get into actually start writing and kind of knowing and exploring the spirits world?
I always call this the confession moment, in that I was probably 47, 48 before somebody, gosh, she was the tourism director in Bardstown, and I was down there doing a story for Southern Living Magazine. Do y'all remember Dawn Pristol?
Oh, yeah.
Dawn? Yeah. Dawn said, we pulled up to Heaven Hill. She said, Steve Coombs, you get out of this car right now, go inside and do that tasting. She said, you're not going to do an article on my town without tasting some bourbon. And believe it or not, honest truth, it really clicked that day. But it was funny that 92 proof larceny lit my mouth on fire to the point of numbness. And I mean, and now we're drinking barrel strength rye, you know, it's no big deal. So I got hooked on it literally just because of the culture. And of course, watching Fred and I worked many years ago together, and seeing what it did for his career and becoming attracted to the characters in the business. My gosh, I mean, I've written about the culinary business for 30 years, and never have I found such a concentration of friendly characters in one single business. Yeah. And you especially talking about how rough it was in the wine industry, you know, how many snobs were in that, and like you didn't want any more involvement with that. The low ego part of this business is just, you know, gold for a writer, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, the characters are amazing. And I remember that time in your career, you called me up, you're like, how did you get here? How'd you do that and all that? And for me, this has always been easy because of the people. And at the time, you were like thinking about, you know, teetering with tequila a little bit. I remember.
I was, and I still love it, but it's a whole country away.
Yeah.
You know? And here we live in the country of bourbon country, and it's right here, and you can drive to Bardstown in 50 minutes and be interviewing the geniuses in the business, or Frankfurt, or, you know, Lawrenceburg.
One of the great things that you've done is that a lot of people come into bourbon, and they kind of repeat the same stories. You know, not a lot of people, you know, try to go outside of what's already been done. And you've done that. And I've been telling you for a long time that people want to be, you know, learn more about ham and the pairings of it. And now you're doing seminars on it and everything. So how did that start? How did you develop this whole new platform that really no one's explored?
Really, and this ties back to you. Hopefully you remember the answer to this.
We've got to stop this kiss fest over
here. Yeah, it is a little smoochy, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right, later, just but turn the lights off.
Let me say this. He mentored me 15 years ago when we were at a company
called...
That's
what he said. He was your supervisor, and he said you're late just like today. No, I'm kidding.
Pretty well.
I'm totally kidding.
I was always on time.
You were. I told him that the company didn't really tolerate that crap, and you still had enough military, you needed to show up on time.
Yeah, that was back when I was still following a little bit of my military code. Now I'm 10 minutes late to everything because I just don't care.
Fred called me in July of, what was it, 2014. You said that a publisher had called you about doing a book on country ham.
That's right.
And you said, I don't know anything about the subject, but I have a feeling I know someone who does. And he called me and he said, call the publisher and see if this will work out for you. And I wound up writing. That was my first book, Country Ham, A Southern Tradition of Hogs, Salt, and Smoke, which came out the year after that. And so by then, I had already begun enjoying bourbon, and I'm tasting it just like we're going to taste today. It was late night. It was, believe it or not, it sounds so fake, but it's really true. It was midnight. I was editing the book and sipping it and tasting it with this and said, oh my gosh, this works really well together.
Yeah, it's a match made in heaven.
Oh, exactly. And that's really where it kind of clicked. But Jay Denham, who is one of the great curers in Kentucky, who's moved back to Cincinnati, had come to me. We were friends. We were talking ham. And he said, you know, we should do a big whiskey and ham pairing sometime. And somehow or another, it led to the Bourbon Classic, and we did one with, Jim Beam. And it was a hit from then. And ever since, I've been doing a lot of these tastings. My gosh, we've got 6 books already this year through March out of town. And it's a lot of fun to spread the gospel of both. I mean, pork gets a bad name in the United States, and this is really good stuff that we're going to try today.
Mm. The other white meat, right?
That's yeah, right. Exactly. Which is the really, really red meat.
Forgot
right
that tagline.
Yeah.
So horrible. I kind of want to rewind it back to you even a little bit more here. So kind of talk, because you were a chef previously in your life too, right? Uh-huh. So kind of talk more about your culinary background.
So my mother was a good Southern cook, but never did I understand restaurant food until I had to start paying my tuition at St. X. And my parents said, you know, times are a little tight. You boys need to get some better jobs if you're going to keep going to St. X and pay for it. So I started working in fine dining. And it was the restaurant that really gave Louisville its own restaurant boom. It was called Casa Grisani. It's long since gone. But that was the first place that I tasted really, really good fresh fish, real asparagus, hollandaise, all these kinds of things. And I realized I was wired for the culinary industry. Didn't know what I wanted to do when I graduated college and was stuck watching the chefs and thought, that looks interesting. I'll try that. I wanted to be a writer. I've always wanted to be a writer, but I was an absolute terrible manual typewriter typist. Mine was the last class at St. X in 1982 that used true manual typewriters, and the best I ever did was 32 words a minute. And that wouldn't get a fly at a newspaper. And about 5 or so years later, I got a laptop. It was an NEC multi-sync, if anybody remembers it. You guys are toddlers.
Yeah, I was about to say.
It weighed 11 and a half pounds.
When it had like a real floppy, like the 5.5 inch floppies?
Two 3.5. No hard drive. And that was the first time that I ever discovered that word processing allowed you to correct your mistakes. I'm like, well, maybe I can do this thing after all. And so I started writing about the restaurant industry. That was 1991. I still do it, not nearly as much because of, you know, publications like yours, and I'm really digging the spirit scene, but to be in it this long and have gotten to travel to really neat places in the world, just writing about food has been a treat, and I'm in a food town. So it's been a good career.
Let me add something to this. He was the editor, in chief of, Pizza Today. And then he later was the editor of a website called Pizza Marketplace. And Steve was a god in pizza around the world. And if you think about pizza, it's like it's its own.
It sounds delicious anyway.
Right.
Steve looks too skinny to be like doing all this food critique.
But he would write about these like pizza dough throwing contests, and it'd be like Italy versus United States or Canada.
Man, that was going on when you were there? Man.
And it was fun for me from a career perspective. That was the first time I had ever seen anyone cover a beat very uniquely. And that I've never told you this, but the way that you owned pizza gave me a lot of like motivation, you know, to discover, you know, in the early times of my career, to find what I could like
your niche,
you know, find my niche like you did. And like he was a god in pizza. And if you Google Steve Coombs, you know, put the quotation marks around it and then pizza, you'll find a lot of his old stuff. And it's beautiful.
I kind of want to talk about pizza for a minute.
I know.
I kind of want to talk about pizza just for a second. So kind of talk about like, how do you judge a pizza? Like in your mind, when you were going in to judge a pizza, like what? How does that work?
The last contest that I did for a long time was in Columbus. That client I was telling you about that I had in up there, it was the Mid-American Pizza Contest. I can't recall, but we judged it on crust quality, crispness. You would look at what, you know, the rim of the crust, which the Italians call the cornicione or the cornice, and you'd look for the texture of the dough. You judge it on the flavor of the sauce, how it presents itself well with cheese. You don't want it to slide off. That's a problem. You look at the ratio of toppings with sauce and crust. And what you look at the marketability of it. Is this thing really something that would sell in a pizza restaurant, or did the guy just make it up on his way in?
And then do you do thumbs up, sideways thumbs, thumbs down?
No, to rate it? There were 38 judges in this contest to manage, you know, the volume of pizzas that were coming through. So you really did have to have a rigorous scoring. You
do pizza quickies now.
Pizza quickies, yeah, we could do
that. Yeah, yeah. So it was pretty rigorous judging, and I'd seen a similar system in Italy, but it's basically based on what, you know, making the Italians win. What's their system?
What style do you prefer? Like the
Neapolitan
or the
style.
Okay, Neapolitan.
Yeah, I really do. Yeah, me too. Neapolitan, New York, go neck and neck.
Yeah.
And
I like to fold mine like a taco.
Foldable floppy.
Yep.
Yeah.
There seems to be a trend right now of people bashing Chicago style pizza, saying it's not really pizza. It's just like a
big it's like old, a lasagna but, or something.
Yeah.
Are you in that?
No, room? Not at all. It's a derivative of an Italian version of pizza called Torta Pasqualina, which means Easter tart or tort. And it was basically, you know, the deep dish, and they would put another layer of crust over the top. And it was like we will roll out a big lasagna for a celebratory event. Hmm. And And that's the way it was treated. It wasn't, you know, the Italians don't see pizza as a slice after slice thing like we eat it here. I mean, we're committed. These dudes have had an appetizer, some wine, the little bit of pizza, then, you know, something afterward. We look at pizza as a whole meal, sometimes our meal.
Yeah.
You know? So,
kind of goes back to that old saying, like, any pizza can be a personal pain if you want to try hard enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, they would look at that at a pizza that size and say, man, that's for 10 people, 12 people, you know, and we look at it sometimes and say, well, you got two friends, we'll split it.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Pizza Pursuit coming to you in 2021.
Yep.
All right. So let's go ahead and kind of dive in here with what we have in front of us. So kind of tell me and tell us a little bit about like what you brought today and variations and why you chose this.
So we have a couple of hams before us today, and I like to focus on people who use the very breeds that Fred was talking about having raised years ago, heritage breed hogs, because the quality of the meat is higher. The fat is much more present. It's better marbled. There's a better cap, like this area here is called, and you get a much better balance of flavor and texture and coating. A lot of the things that we talk about with bourbon, but only presented in a solid form. I also, when I did the book several years ago, I really got to taste a lot of country ham, and these specific cures are the ones that I really like to use in presentations. I have found that their meat tastes best with whiskey out of, you know, many others, partly because of the fat, partly because of the complexity that's gained in aging, just like bourbon.
Yeah, I was about to ask like what the rigorous process of testing all that was like to be able to figure out exactly what would pair well and what.
No more rigorous than you guys sitting at the bar just tasting lots of different things and logging it somewhere in your memory or a notepad. It's just tasting and tasting and tasting and tasting and thinking it through. It's again like bourbon. A little goes a long way. You don't need a ton of country ham. 3 ounces of country ham would give you your full RDA dose of salt. Mm-hmm. So you don't need much of it. But I've really gotten to where I'm very fond of this first ham nearest us is from the Hammery in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. This is a guy who, his name is Bob Woods, and he's the one that coined my favorite phrase that I use in presentations. And he said, "Steve, country ham ain't nothing but hillbilly prosciutto." And that's what it is. A traditional ham is cured with salt only. A country ham is cured with salt and sugar and various other peppers if you like. But that's basically the difference.
Now, okay, these particular pigs you talked about that are they fed a specific diet, or are they just like in Italy I've seen, you know, the swine are fed like acorns only and like massaged, you know.
True, that's for the prosciutto to Parma hogs. But they do like to let them get out in free range. And did you guys, or did you have to keep them in pens or...
It varied. You know, there were some breeds that we would let kind of roam. Chester hogs were ones that we would let roam around. You could kind of trust them, and they were diggers.
They root the hell out of property.
Yeah, they were real rooters.
What's a rooter mean? Guys, you got to understand.
They dig with their nose.
I'm a city slicker,
they
okay?
They dig with their noses into the ground to get at grubs and such, right?
Right, yeah. So they also like to get a nice cool spot to get underneath there. The Berkshires were runners, and so like if you let them out, there's a pretty good chance a coyote would get it, you know, because they would go out in the woods or something. And the Durocs were really, they were just kind of lazy. They didn't really want to do anything. So even if you open the pen up, they'd be like, yeah, there's a lot out there, and I got this water bucket here. We're good.
I love the accent, Durocs, because here in Kentucky, it'd be Durock.
Oh, yeah. That's,
yeah, same spelling. Yeah.
It's just like Hamon and Jamon.
Well, what's fascinating about that is that we would buy hogs from all over the country, you know, because we were competitive. We were showmen. We were competitive, you know, trying to win jackpot hog shows and stuff. And we'd go to Illinois, which Illinois had like a... For a long time, they had like the best genetics for Hampshires, and everybody was trying to get a little bit of Hampshire in their breeding processes. And you would go there, you couldn't even understand them. They'd say hag, you know, the different enunciations of the breeds. It's fascinating. You can, it's one of the few kind of like words where you can tell where someone's from based on how they pronounce breeds.
Yeah.
And if you look at all of them, they're all, most of the breeds come from like some kind of European, you know.
When you said free range, so like I'm trying to think like a, you know, a cow, like if you have grass fed beef or versus like corn fed. Corn fed's like much more fatter, like more flavorful for me anyways. Whereas you get grass fed, it's kind of more grainy, kind of earthy kind of flavors. Is that, do they do the similar things with pigs or?
Absolutely. I mean, you can tell the difference. I mean, it just tastes this against some neutral pork sometime that if you cured it and you just, if it didn't have that diet to begin with, it's not going to influence the meat.
And a thing too that they do with all animals, and it's very prevalent amongst swine, is that they actively add antibiotics because these things are always getting sick. You know, if one of them gets you know, some kind of flu or some kind of cold, it could wipe out an entire herd or a farrowing house, which has all the piglets in it, and you lose your entire investment. So a lot of these farmers will actively add antibiotics into the feed. And so like when you hear someone talking about free range or natural, or a lot of that means is that they're getting a feed that is not as, you know, doped up, if you will. And also like they're able
fortified. So yeah, like not the GMO corn thing for, you know, wild turkey hangs their hat on that, you know. But does it make a difference in the, you know, antibiotics versus non-antibiotics with the meat flavor?
I've never heard anybody
say
whether. It just always,
I think it's
you would know better than I, sure.
I think a lot of, also too, when you look at this, a lot of like ham and sausages is about the processing. So very few people are actually just getting the, you know, getting the meat from a hog, you know, slicing it and cooking two of them, you know, the same way. Everyone's doing a sauce or they're doing a special cure. I think it's very, it's not like beef where you can cut, you get two steaks, slap it on there, cook it up, and you can tell, you know, it's very different with this because much of the art is in the curing. And I'm very fascinated with the art of curing because we go into warehouses in Kentucky, you know, bourbon warehouses like Willett, and you can see these little, you know, hams just kind of in the rafters.
We won't talk about that.
All right. We'll save that for a later subject.
Now I want to talk about it.
Yeah, I know.
I have my opinion on that.
Well, let's go ahead. We'll come back to
let's
it.
Taste.
Let's definitely taste. I kind of want you to kind of talk us through, you know, what we have and like what we're pairing it with. You already talked about what we have, and then we went on
all right, each tangent. Despite what your mother's told you.
So what do we have, right and left? Or?
So let's go with the front one, the one closest to you. This is from the Hammery. This is an 18 to 20-month-old ham that's called a Tenshudo. So I'm like Fred. I like to hold it up. I like to see the marbling in it.
Oh, wow. I've never done an official meat. Like, oh, wow.
I could, can you imagine being a... I don't know if I've ever gone to a restaurant and been like...
I know. Seen anyone do this.
I don't do that in a restaurant.
Can you bring a light to this?
Can you bring me a flashlight?
But smell it. I mean...
Or I guess like I'm going to use my phone.
This particular ham has a huge Parmesan cheese note to me, but it also has that very porky note, that barnyard note that I love.
Parmesan cheese is definitely there on it.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah. And I just like to lay it right on my tongue.
I don't think I've ever gone through and like tried to, I'm assuming since you do this and you judge and you try to do the palate tasting and trainings, like it's the same way you do with a bourbon. You're sitting there, you're looking at the color, you're looking and you're actually smelling it and you're nosing it the same way you would do with a whiskey or something like that.
Believe it or not, the way they judge ham contests, you don't see the internal part of the ham. It's never cut to look at. It is, in Italy, they typically use the horse's cannon bone and they kind of sharpen it down to a point. And they stick it into the near the H bone of the ham to see if the thing is properly cured. Because you know instantly by that aroma that comes out. They'll stick it to their nose and say yay or nay. And that's one of the criteria for judging here in Kentucky is that thing properly cured? And so you put it in a couple of parts of, get the Beavis and Butthead joke in, the butt face of the ham. And so they're checking on aroma, they're checking on appearance, how it's trimmed. Typically a country ham is smoked, so that the way that is colored is important. They don't want it just super mahogany. Like Western Kentucky cures will do that sometimes. It's not a favorable.
Is it typical thing to use mahogany wood for smoking, or they use all
oak.
Different? Okay.
Oak is really common. Or I'm sorry, hickory.
Hickory, okay.
So yeah, it's much more superficial than you would think. They'll probably palpate it, you know, smash it around some, but that it's not nearly as intense as you might think. But taste that with the toasted, which is on the left.
You know who's going to love this is Lauren when she edits this. us like smacking our lips. We're in the chewing. She's always like, never do that.
Well, nice sound effects, though.
Yeah. As if this didn't have enough brown sugar on its own. This really bumps it up. Andrea Wilson at Michter's and I talk about when we do these pairings, we want to complement, contrast, or elevate when we make a pairing. Complement means they go well together. Contrast means they make each other interesting. Elevate means each makes the other better. And I think this is a pairing, that, a pairing that elevates.
So why go with the toasted on this one? What was the significance behind that one?
Just it's a simple, approachable whiskey. I mean, who doesn't like toasted? It's not my favorite of the Michter's line, but I really, really like it. And it just pairs well with food. I've paired with a lot of foods, and I think you guys can jump in on this with me. But for some reason, the Michter's line pairs better than any. And I'm thinking that there are two things that are noticeably different from everything else we've done. And that's low barrel entry proof and low proof in the bottle. And for some reason, that seems to result in a really good pairing with food. I don't know if you've ever thought that through, but
no, I mean,
I guess with the alcohol overpower.
Yeah, I would say that's probably, but I think everyone's different too. You know, some people have, you know, burned their palates out. And they need that barrel proof all the time. I wanted to ask you a question about like the sliced country ham always feels thicker to me than prosciutto. And when I was in Italy and I was at a prosciutto place and they had me go behind it and cut, they let me cut. And I used, mm-hmm. actually did the bone. And when I cut, they were like, you're too thick. Get out of here. So it wasn't that thick. It was like this. But so why, what's the difference between like, you know, the standards of the thickness?
What do you get if you mix Seattle Craft, Texas Heritage, and Scottish Know-How? That's Two Bar Spirits. Two Bar Spirits traces its roots to a ranch in rural Texas run by the founder, Nathan Kaiser's family for six generations. Nathan grew up on the ranch with stories of relatives bootlegging moonshine. And after moving into Seattle, he wanted to keep the family tradition alive and he opened Two Bar Spirits in 2012. They're a very traditional distillery, making everything from scratch and each day starts by milling 1,000 pounds of grain. Their entire product lineup consists of only two whiskeys, their moonshine and the only bourbon made in Seattle. Both bottles are being featured in Rackhouse Whiskey Club's next box. Rackhouse Whiskey Club is a Whiskey of the Month club, and they're on a mission to uncover the best flavors and stories that craft distilleries across the U.S. have to offer. Rackhouse ships out two of the featured distillery's finest bottles, along with some cool merchandise in a box delivered to your door every 2 months. Go to rackhousewhiskeyclub.com to check it out and try some Two Bar for yourself. Use code PURSUIT for $25 off your first box.
What's the difference between, like, you know, the standards of the thickness in country
ham? I think it's a great question. In the United States, certainly in the southern United States, where country ham is most prevalent, people don't eat it. People, I say, eat it raw. No, not eating it raw. It's cured. It is chemically and physically transformed into a shelf-stable product. So it's cured. It's not raw. My mother was one of many who just abused ham, country ham, and would cook it to a, you probably had it, Ryan, in Barstown, a baseball leather consistency. And it intensified the salt. It was just overwhelming and absolutely no fun. But when I did this book, I can't tell you how many people, how many curers did not like it like this. They thought that this is, you know, I kind of like it with a little red-eye gravy or whatever. I'm like, this is the best expression.
Yeah.
This is the barrel strength expression of their product.
Wow.
Essentially. Or throw it in a sandwich with tomato and, you know, lettuce and pickles.
Well, done like that, I've enjoyed it too at Nancy Newsom's place. I think I posted a photo a couple days ago of it. But yeah, Fred, this is the charcuterie cut that really shows, to me, respects the product at its natural best.
And did you cut it?
I not like you're talking about, like off the ham yeah. itself, I'd still be doing it to try to get these things done. You got to be an expert to do that. I can do it, but I'm slow. I have a commercial slicer in my house.
Oh, okay. Nice. Yeah. I know what I'm getting at Costco next. Commercials.
I'll help you find one on the used market. It'll be a lot better. Okay, you'll wear one out with a ham.
I got a question. Time. After you cut,
yes, sir.
You know, because it's cured, do you have to do anything to like seal it to preserve it? Or how do you preserve it after you've already cut into it?
Well, before we started, you probably saw me taking it out of those vacuum packages. Mm-hmm. I just do that.
Put
it
between some you already going. Well, I'm talking about the actual whole ham. What do you do with that after?
I like to break it down into as large sections of muscle as I can, both to make it easier to slice, but to do, as you say, get it into a vacuum package and seal it that okay. way. So the more muscle integrity you have, the better it's going to be preserved. I can keep them in a refrigerator or a freezer for a long, long period of time, and they're fine.
What size do these typically come in when, say, you want to go buy a leg of ham?
A country ham, depending on the maker or the curer, I should say, starts out at about 22, 23 pounds green weight. Do you ever call it that, too? Green? That seems to be an industry term. And
What's that mean, though?
It means...
Fresh?
Yeah, fresh, jiggling, wiggling.
So it's basically like trying to buy like an 8-ounce filet or an 8-ounce steak, and then you cook it, and then.
But that's probably been dry aged for a little while. Maybe, so this thing was oinking, 48 hours ago.
All right then.
So
remember my role
came straight from Butcher Town.
Hogs. It was raising them, put them on a truck, and say goodbye.
Give me the check.
Once they were, that was it.
Don't name them.
I did name a couple of them.
I don't know. I
did, yeah. But
they'll shrink to about, if they start out at 22, they'll be ready, at about a year at 17 pounds. So they lose that's their angel share, mm-hmm. them losing that moisture to intensify the flavors that are inside the ham and to trigger, I'm trying to think of and it's an enzymatic reaction that really makes the meat shelf stable. All that works together, and it works together because the place we live, just like bourbon is so good here because of our climate, the same thing happens to hams. That, once you hang them outside and let them be subject to the weather, it's amazing. There's not that many places in the world that you can do this.
Well, I've always wanted to get into like curing my own ham or something like that. Because I know a few people in a few different bourbon groups, and that's like one of their kind of like side projects or side hobbies. Is
1789 guy?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. They've got some good ones going.
Yeah, so
I'll do it with you.
One of theirs is in my refrigerator at home.
Well, right perfect, now. Perfect. Because I don't even know like even the process of how you would even start doing that. A, you'd have to acquire the leg, but B, like what's the next step in that process?
It's pretty crude, frankly. It's you trim away certain parts of the ham to make it look good, and you rub the hell out of it with curing salt. You're sticking in every little nook and cranny because you want to get that salt in there to penetrate to the bone and push the water out, essentially. As curers would say, it's a race to the bone. If bacteria gets to the bone of the ham first, you've lost your ham. If salt gets there first, you've got a cured ham. And what it does basically is create by getting the water out, it starves the bacteria. That's what they need to thrive. And that's all the salt does is pushes it out. And of course, flavors it mm-hmm. a great deal too.
I just did the second pairing. I'm sorry, I jumped ahead. I couldn't wait.
I did it too.
Oh my God.
It's perfect.
My God.
I mean, it was funny, like going into this, I have a little bit of, I want to say a criticism, but I have a little bit of that kind of, I hold back a little bit, be like, oh, can you really pair like ham and bourbon together? Holy shit. Yeah, you can. Right.
See, that's what's so fun about this is to see that happen and people's, the scales fall from their eyes. They go, really? You can do this?
Well, I mean, I think it kind of just gives you a little bit more, a benefit to hear to say like, okay, you were able to show me like, for me to sit there and say like, I don't even know where I would go and find 8 different kinds of ham to even start experimenting with around here. But if I did, and I came down here to my basement and I started pulling, a Jefferson's Reserve, I started pulling a Booker's, I pulled, whatever, you name it, across the line and tried to figure out like, how do these pair? I don't really know if I'd be able to do that. So I guess when you're doing this, what are some of those nuances or flavors in a ham or at a bourbon that you're trying to pair with a particular one.
Man, Kenny, I wish I could French it up and give you some fascinating answer, but it is mostly trial and error. But the key attribute that I want from the ham, too, actually, from a country ham, is fat content to coat the palate and smoke, a little bit of smoke in there. Salt is everywhere. It doesn't matter. The chew, you know, I know how to cut the ham correctly so it chews correctly. So really, it's fat. And one of the virtues of a whiskey that pairs well is that it cleanses the palate.
Yeah.
And this so what we tasted here just a second ago that Fred and Kenny cheated on wisely was a 24-month-old Broadbent's country ham.
Yeah, Broadbent's.
Done from a Berkshire hog.
Yeah.
Yeah, Berkshire.
Old breed, yeah.
And it's just as, there's no accident that this has won the company's won the Kentucky State Fair Country Ham Championship 18 times out of 53 or so.
Now, what would this ham cost?
This ham would cost $199, which is an absolute bargain, but it's an absolute huge piece of meat. 17 pounds of ham minus
you
bone.
You want to split one, Kenny?
I'm in. I'm all in.
I'm in.
See?
Yeah.
This one smells, I haven't tasted it. Does it smell smokier or is it
a little
smokier?
Bit, a little bit. Because remember, the only part that gets the smoke essentially is the skin and the butt face. Again, the butt face, to do a little illustration, would be this area that is cut away from the torso of the hog. That's the exposed hip. So, but smoke does walk its way in and permeate. Mm. You know, I don't know how long they smoke their hams, probably 3 days, you know, at low temp. But this is the Michter's 10-year rye. Absolutely elevates that to, I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, because the Michter's rye and the toasted sour mash are completely different taste profiles, right? Yeah, I mean, the rye isn't, it's not overly rye, but it definitely has a 10-year character to it where it's a little bit more oaky, a little bit more darker influence, whereas the toasted sour mash, and I always get this with any of the Michter's toasted products, tastes overly sweet, or it tastes just really super sweet because they do that toasting process to the secondary barrel finish. So that's kind of the way that I'm seeing it, and the kind of way that I'm pairing these different kind of hams as well, is that the second one we tried had a little bit more of that, almost, I don't want to say like oak age or character to it, but it definitely had some more of that richness, if you will. Right.
Yeah, it's creamy, like buttery.
Creamy, exactly.
I mean, you don't even have to chew it. Like the first one you gotta chew, this one you can just let it sit on your tongue and like just disintegrates.
That's another reason why it's cut that thin too.
Yeah.
You want that fat to melt.
Mm. Yeah, that's incredible.
And the thing about this Michter's, either the straight rye or the 10-year, in fact the barrel strength does it as well. The best pairing that I've ever come up with, and totally by accident, is this Broadbent's and Michter's rye. And I said it at a pairing one time. Does anybody taste spearmint gum? And Heather Green jerks her hand up. Oh, wow. She said, yes. She said, it was so weird. I didn't want to say it in public. Heather Green, of all people. You know, for her to get it, it was exciting. And it does. You guys get that? I mean, we all get spearmint from rye, but that's just like spearmint gum, just candy. Maybe it's lending itself to that sweetness that you're talking about in the Michter's.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there like a... You know, you have country hams that come from, like I've gone to Garage Bar and they have different country hams from different regions. So you have Virginia, Tennessee, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. You're probably biased because we live in Kentucky, but what is the best region or what do you think is the best?
I really think it's maker by maker. There are some hams in Kentucky that I'm not crazy about, and there are some unbelievable ones coming out of Virginia that I love. And these typically are century old companies. So I love out of Virginia. My favorite is the Edwards, the Suriano ham is fantastic. In Kentucky, we have Newsom, which is brilliant. Oh gosh, Broadbent's we talked about. Father's is pretty good. I won't mention the ones I don't like. I love in Kentucky. I love the Hammery. I'm sorry, Tennessee. And Benton's.
Yeah, Ben's.
Benton's is a bruiser in a pairing because it's so smoky, heavily hickory smoked, and it's fun to get. You know, the whiskey that pairs best with it, the Michter's American. That ordinary, just, what is it, 82 proof?
Yeah.
And it's perfect. It's an elevation that you got to experience.
Yeah, if you hadn't had Benton's bacon or their country ham, it's life-changing.
You took up smoking or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
One of the challenges that I find is the availability and knowing where to buy country ham. You walk into Kroger and there'll be like an entire like corner aisle space dedicated to country ham, and they're just kind of thrown in there. And I'm like, you know, for that reason, I can't get my wife to eat country ham with me because she's like, No, I don't want that.
Because it's got maybe that, it's a little like, over daunting too, right?
You don't want a big pile of meat sitting on a shelf in the store.
So where, like
15 pounds of ham for where like can people 6 months?
Where can people buy country ham? And is that stuff in the middle aisle next to the yogurt any good at Kroger?
Yeah, gotta think of the national audience.
That's like, good for making green beans.
Yeah, like what would be the best like way that they would go about purchasing something like this?
I'm delivering myself from the bliss of that pairing. That is just freaking fantastic.
I'm still in the bliss.
I mean,
I can't blame Jacqueline for that's Fred's wife. In case people don't know, I can't blame her for not wanting that because I think the presentation's horrible at the retail level for that. I think the country ham industry is its own worst enemy many times, and understanding what it needs to do to make itself look on par with Italian cured hams.
Yeah, you tell my wife it's charcuterie, she's like, oh yeah. You say it's country ham, she's like, oh no way.
It's like it's the same thing.
That's exactly right, and it needs to take its place on the stage. To get around to what you're talking about, Fred, the only place in town that would cut it a cured ham this way is Red Hog Butcher.
Oh wow.
And it will cost an arm and a hog leg to do it. But it will be extraordinarily good. They're fantastic curers there. But you can call any of these people directly at the, you know, at Benton's or the Hammery or wherever, and ask them to cut that for you and vacuum seal it and send it. The only drawback to that is it gets really compressed under the vacuum, and it's very difficult to peel off. It's like ham chips. So that's one of the reasons why I got a commercial slicer, because I didn't want to, I wait as late as I can before a presentation to cut it and bring it out.
There's a couple of places in Bardstown you can get a really good. Old Delaney's is one of you ever shop there?
No, where's
Old
that?
Old Delaney's. So it's on Bardstown Road right before you get in. It's like right across from Nazareth.
Sure, closer to Cox Creek.
Exactly. Yeah. And then Boone's Butcher Shop too. They have excellent ham, and Keen's too. So there's three places.
What about the place that it sells, you can buy guns, and
that's
then
Keen's.
Keen's.
Keen's, Boone's.
It's Kentucky Gun Company now, but yes, it's formerly known as Keen's. Yeah, but they still do the country. So you can get your gun and your ham right there.
I went in there and I was like, is that a 50 caliber? And is that like country ham?
That's
like
next to the 20-pound leg of ham.
Get you a Glock and a ham hock in the same place. Yeah.
you can cure with gunpowder, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh my! That's
add it to your bourbon trail trip now.
So that sounds like that might be the best way for someone to get these great country hams.
And it needs to change, here. Fred. I mean, you're making an observation that I've complained to the industry about and said you guys have got to understand your position as charcuterie makers, if you're going to take advantage of what's happening in every single state, you know, those boards coming out on tables, you know, those are populated with Spanish and Italian hams. We import 4 million European hams a year, and yet we only make 2.5 million country hams a year, and less than, personally, I'm thinking less than 200,000 of them are worth eating like this. So 10%. The rest are in that pile in the grocery store. So
maybe they need to take a book out of bourbon's, you know, play out bourbon's playbook and like do like, I don't know, not single barrel ham, but like single, you know, like kind of
single leg.
Yeah, single leg ham or something. Yeah.
I'm gonna put our name in first. We're gonna do the first single leg.
We're gonna pursuit series, single leg ham.
Oh my gosh. But the interesting thing about these people is the similarity between them and the distillers in this business is they have no ego. They love their craft, they love the product, but getting them into the spotlight, like in book promotions and things like that, was difficult for them. There are very few of them who can really enjoy the attention, because how many distillers do we know that say, you know, I wish I'd get the hell off the road. I just want to make whiskey. You know, this it's nice. I love people that love, you know, that love us, and I sign their, you know, bottles or whatnot, but I want to go home and make whiskey. This is kind of the way the country ham makers are. They're not full of themselves. They're wonderful people.
Yeah.
Mm. So now there's a mission out there. Now there's one thing that I think we want to get to, and I think it kind of sparked Fred's interest too. So we talked about curing hams in rick houses. So we want to get your opinion on it.
I'm not doing a mum's the word or a Fifth Amendment. I'm just chewing.
But he is collecting his thoughts.
But I mean, there is something, at least maybe it's maybe it's from our untrained, you know, untrained knowledge of it. You know, like when we go and you walk through a Rick house and you see a ham leg and you're like, oh, that's a great idea. And then, you know, they tell you the idea that, oh, the angel share goes into the ham leg. And then you try it at events and you're like, oh, this is fantastic. And maybe it's just all in your head.
It's all placebo.
Maybe it is.
I before you get into that, I want to say, like, in the meat world, when I see those things, all I can think about is like, there's got to be some gnat that's drilled its way through there. There's got to be some kind of like bug that might have gotten on it. Who does that add to the curing, by the way?
No, it detracts from it. And you're correct. The first time I saw those hams hanging at Willett, I was with Drew Colesveen walking through a Rick house, and it was June and there were flies all over one of those hams. And I said, are those yours? And he said, no. I'll leave out the name of who's, well, what the hell? Sean Brock.
Yep.
They were Sean Brock's.
Everybody knows.
And I said, that's not good to have those flies on there. He's like, what's the problem? I said, well, they lay their eggs, and if they lay their eggs in that meat, they'll become skippers. Or not skippers, but yeah, it is skippers. They don't become a full-fledged fly. They bore into the meat and just eat and go
like
and go.
Like maggots almost, yeah.
Yeah, but not as handsome. So, a little joke there, fellas. That was a little bug joke.
I get it. I get it now.
They're just thinking about the secondary value of their Willett ham.
I've already ate it.
I was just saying it flew over my head.
So, get it? Oh. So oddly enough, right, you know, I knew what happens with those things. And oddly enough, somebody who had no idea of what that conversation, that it had happened in December of that same year, showed me this picture of those hams. And he said, do you know anything about these? And I looked at him and it was Willett, but they had pillowcases over them. That's what I'd said to Drew. I said, you at least got to cover them up with something. And he's like, well, Sean knows what he's doing. I was like, yeah, Sean does know what he's doing in a lot of things, but I was smart enough to know that that wasn't a good idea. So you've got to keep the insects off because it'll make a terrible mess. And they're not, you know, we thought one time I had a batch that happened to. And we were, remember Chef Richard at Audubon Hospital?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He and I were doing them. We were using, I mean, pretty sizable bullets on those things. And they're not even fun target practice. They just swallow the whole bullet. It's no fun. So there's nothing fun about skippers. Let's just say that. Mm-hmm. Would they pick up on the angel share? Nobody that I know has ever said that happens.
Yeah, I think
it's gimmicky. But why not try? Why not try? Chris Chamberlain, you know Chris, right?
Yeah, the Nashville writer.
Yeah, do you guys know him?
I do not.
Great guy. No. He was at the tasting for that batch of hams, and he said he wouldn't even walk near the table. He didn't know anything about him. I saw pictures in his Nashville Scene story, and I said, hey, I know where those came from. What were they like? He said, I wouldn't get near the table.
Oh, I was all over the table that night. I was there.
Were you there?
Oh, yeah. Are we talking about Whiskey Pig?
I don't know that was it.
Okay.
Might have been an event.
Yeah. But
yeah, I had like probably like 9 or 10 helpings.
Oh,
yeah.
But you know, let's be fair. Sean Brock here. Sean Brock's smart. So he probably figured out that you got to cover him up. And then it's not that difficult to cure ham, just if the weather cooperates.
Mm-hmm. Is that really what all it comes down to?
It's a lot of it. And it's not cooperating right now. So I've got two hams in my refrigerator, one for a 1789 guy that we can't take outside. We're wanting to take him to Booker Knows Ham House. Y'all been to his house, right? And been to have you seen the witch peaked ham house in the back?
I had no idea Booker Know had a ham house.
Oh, that was his thing. And you could easily put in 100 hams into that house if you wanted to.
Wow.
And Fred Know said,
there you go, Kenny, life goals.
When I was going to put one in a couple of years ago, I said, do you mind if I come put one in? He said, you just got to let Sandy know. That's his wife. And he said, as long as you're not taking one out and you're putting one in, it's okay. So we're just waiting for the weather to cool down, and hopefully it's going to happen.
By the way, that's a really good Sandy impression.
She's awesome.
Yeah. Have you ever met Sandy, Fred Know's wife? He just sounded just like her. Her act. It was amazing.
She's a hoot. You can't be a wallflower in that family getting attention.
No, they're good people.
Yeah. Great people. Yeah.
Well, so, absolutely. Steve, I want to say thank you again for coming on today and kind of like guiding us through here. You know, I think I want to leave one last opportunity for you to kind of like tell people, you know, where they can learn more about you, where they can find your books, where they can book you for a ham and bourbon pairing, everything like that.
So my website is Steve, or stevecoombs.com. I was looking at my email address, may as well do it. So stevecoombs.com on the web, steve at stevecoombs.com via email. I do ham pairings wherever, food pairings, really. You can also learn a great deal about country hams in the book. What is it? Country Ham, A Southern Tradition of Hogs, Salt, and Smoke. You can find that at Amazon.com or stevecoombs.com. I prefer you do that because I get a better cut of the game.
There's the author party you come out.
Yep. And there are a lot of...
always selling.
I do a lot of stuff around Kentucky. Just if you see a big bourbon event, I'm probably going to have a pairing there somewhere. But anyway, yeah, call me and email me. We can chat about it.
Well, it's fantastic. Fun. And thank you so much for bringing the ham and the bourbon today.
Yes, that was my lunch.
Yeah, there wasn't any bourbon here.
Whiskeys.
I figured that was a risk.
Yeah.
Down to your last 500 bottles just behind it.
running low. We need replenishments here. But no, it was a fantastic. Again, thank you for bringing the ham, bringing the whiskey, and honestly, opening my eyes up as well. Like, I want to buy more ham and prosciutto and stuff like that and kind of like figure out how I can do this on my own, because I think it's very interesting. You just got to be able to find those right flavors. And I think for a lot of the bourbon people out there, if you go and you taste bourbon, you know what bourbon tastes like, and then you taste the ham, I think that's probably the better way to go about it. Instead of tasting the ham first and being like, oh, where'd this kind of fit in? But if you know your bourbon categories and you kind of make those mental notes of certain notes, or kind of, like I said, from what I'm finding in a lot of here, it's a lot of that richness, smoky flavors and stuff like that. And you can try to find those pairings.
Exactly. It's smoky flavor from the barrel. Pairs really well. Elevates, as I like to say.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep. Just don't get the ones at the grocery store that's in the big stack.
Apparently not.
Not much flavor there. No complexity.
Next to the like Oscar Mayer wieners and stuff, you know.
Actually, they're always like by like the bad cuts of every meat.
Yeah.
And like macaroni and cheese or
like
something.
Stew roast and stuff.
Yeah.
Ryan will be back next.
Potted meat.
Yeah.
Yep.
Ryan will be back next week with hot dog and bourbon pairings.
Oh yeah.
Hey,
keep it real classy.
That could happen.
Be the peasant that I am.
Jim Beam white label with everything, folks.
Well, awesome, Steve. Thank you again for coming on and sharing your story, sharing your ham and your whiskey with us. We definitely appreciate it. If you have any opportunity, you like this podcast, make sure you go ahead and rate it. You can go to ratethispodcast.com/bourbon. You can go ahead and leave a review there. If you also like to support us even more, we have a Patreon. Go ahead, check it out, patreon.com/bourbonpursuit. Ryan, Fred, anything to close it up with?
No, that was great. Thanks for lunch.
I just want to say how proud I am of you. You've had an incredible career and a huge impact on my life. And one of the best pizzas I've ever had in my life was in his home. He's an amazing chef. Wow. And a great human being.
We need to do this next time at your house and have a dinner party.
You're going to haul it all over there. We'll
Hey, could we seriously pull off a pizza and bourbon pairing?
I don't know.
Man, that's tough contrast.
That's a lot of acid. It works.
Maybe we break into cocktails. Bring Jackie on the show. And
now you're talking.
We can try all of it. That's how I learned that there's no science to this. Just trial and error.
Let's do it.
All right.
Well, get on the calendar, Kenny.
All right. Cheers, everybody. We'll see you all next week.